So today we're going to talk about the end stage of massive stars. Ken will talk about spherical stability, exotic phenomena, and I will concentrate on more standard supernova explosion, driven by neutrinos. And in between, two topics. There is a third category, which we won't talk about in the case of bipolar magnetic explosions, for which we ask questions to Ken Doronto. So in preparing this talk, I realized that in our community of corporate supernova people interested in understanding how the stars explode, we define parameters which are relevant to the success or the failure of the explosion, but we don't always connect those parameters. So those parameters are defined during the collapse, after the beginning of the collapse, during the phase of stone accretion shock on this potential star which has just formed. And those parameters are not always easily connected to the stellar structure, to the pre-collapse stellar structure. So this may be one interesting outcome of this effort, is to try to establish a better connection between those important parameters and what it means during the stellar life. So soon I will need my slides. the framework of maybe it's a good moment to say that the theory of stellar explosion, of massive star explosions, is not in a very good shape, but in much better shape than 10 years ago or 20 years ago. So you can really view this in a positive manner. and so maybe it's important as an introduction to when you look at those explosion mechanism papers, it's quite important to distinguish ab initio methods and parametrized explosions. And so one of the big what makes people optimistic about this scenario rather than any other scenario is that the ab initio method gives encouraging results. It's true that I will not discuss this during this this morning, but it's true that 3D explosions are 3D simulations. Now that computers allow us to have three-dimensional simulations, we are a bit disappointed that in 3D the explosion scenario seems to be maybe even more difficult to obtain a powerful explosion than in 2D. People have relied on 2D axis symmetric simulations for a long time, and the 3D simulations is a new challenge, both computationally, but also it asks new questions about the efficiency of the mechanism. So there are reasons to be worried about those difficulties, but still the main driver is that from first principles, those simulations manage to obtain some explosions. And this is something that 10 years ago was completely, it was a dream 10 years ago. So so here I have illustrated both the ab initio approach, where my colleagues in Garching, for example, put all the relevant physics with as few as possible free parameters. And here is the goal that people try to reach. So this is an attempt in this paper by Sugbold and collaborators to map the full domain of progenitors. So those are the progenitors of Stein-Huxley from 10 to 120 solar masses, and try to describe as well as they can in a 1D approach, incorporating some recipes, some parametrized recipes to account for multi-D effects. They try to account for the full distribution of outcomes. So here you have the zero age main sequence mass, and here in the green lines here tell you the mass of the neutron star when you have an explosion. The black lines show you black hole outcome of the collapse, and the red the mass in red gives you the mass of the ejecta, and this mass in black gives you the mass of the helium core, and the hydrogen envelope is in yellow. So this is really what we would like to have, a global panorama of the outcome of the collapse of massive stars. But unfortunately, this is very far from being ab initio, as I said, and so there are many possible criticisms to this picture. And so the typical parameters which are involved in supernova physics, I mean in the core collapse explosion mechanism, are of course the zero age main sequence and the compacity, which is really taken into account in this kind of approach. But we know that there are different instabilities which take place during the first second of the collapse, which are mainly neutrino-driven convection and the standing accretion shock instability, for which we have a series of parameters which are important. We will see that the compacity parameter is not a fully satisfactory parameter to describe the outcome of the collapse, and so additional parameters have been defined, and some recent input to this field have taken into account the effect of pre-collapse inhomogeneities, which are important for stellar evolution because it's really the turbulent energy of oxygen burning which is going to be helpful to power the explosion, I mean to trigger the explosion. And I would like, if I have time, to talk about the impact of rotation, which is my main interest at the moment, in particular on its impact on the properties of the pulsar. Okay.
So when you say this is like a main parameter, some way impact, but so the neutrino-driven convection is kind of a parameter, but not a self-consistent.
Which parameter?
The neutrino-driven convection in SASI. Is it a parameter, or it's so a self-consistent thing that you get?
It's a self-consistent. This is a self-consistent physical process which you get naturally if you allow for multi-D. So here you have to parameterize it in 1D. And there is a parameter which tells you that this physical process, for example, can be stable in some circumstances, and it's not clear in this parameter space which are the stars for which this neutrino-driven convection will be inefficient.
This is in the gain region, not inside the neutrino sphere, is that what you mean?
Yes, I mean in the gain region, and you're right to mention that inside the neutrino sphere there's also interesting convective processes due to the electron fraction, which I will not comment right now, but we can discuss it. Yeah.
Can you help us understand why the so-called figure, for example, like a 17.1 solar mass star collapses into 17.2, doesn't, and a 17.3 does.
Yeah, yeah. So we will come to that in more detail. We will look at this graph in more detail. So the I have a full slide on this. So the framework, I guess you are all familiar with, is this traditional neutrino-driven delayed explosion, where neutrinos have been trapped inside the proton star, proton neutron star, and so it takes some time for them to diffuse out of the neutrino sphere. The shock, the accretion shock, stalls because a lot of energy. There are two main losses of energy. One is the dissociation of ion across the shock into protons, neutrons, and electrons. And the other big loss of energy is that the neutrinos escaping the neutron star and the neutrinos produced by electron by a neutronization escape very easily. So there are two big losses. And as a consequence, this shock, instead of bouncing, this shock stalls for a fraction of a second. And here I write the energy budget, rotational energy in units of the final spin period of the neutron star if angular momentum were conserved. And you see that the typical energy of rotation for a normal neutron star, I'm not talking of a neutron star at breakup, is small, is a factor 10 smaller than the kinetic energy of the ejecta, which is 10 to the 51. So if we deal with normal supernova explosion, we cannot really rely on rotational energy. But of course, we have this big reservoir of potential energy from which neutrinos are going to feed. So the state of the art of the most advanced ab initio simulation is shown in this movie of the Garshin group. So this was a 27 solar mass progenitor. In yellow you have the accretion shock. So in black you have the infall of matter. This is about 150 kilometers in radius.
What mass are we looking at this point?
So inner mass is 1.5. You have a proton neutron star in the middle, which is like 1.2 or 3.
We're not that.
And it's accreting
that blob doesn't go out for the whole 27 solar mass.
No, this is just a very inner region of the
star.
Yeah. Just 150 kilometers in radius.
Great.
And you saw two things. You saw blobs on small scale, and you saw a large scale motion. So this illustrates the two actors of this dynamics, the main actors, which are the neutrino-driven convection responsible for these small blobs. And what you saw and what stopped was this large-scale sloshing motion due to the shock instability that we called SASI.
So does this explode? It doesn't look like it.
This does not explode.
Okay. Yeah, so that was 150 million CPU hours to not explode.
You could have used
that. When you do a simulation, I will be the advocate of such simulations. The same group, still the Garshin group, the same group also does parametrized studies or analytical studies. But it's important from time to time to check if things work when you put all the ingredients together. So this particular simulation was not 150 million CPU hours because I think they were able to run three or four models with this. Okay, so if you look at the perturbative properties of those instabilities, so you have really two distinct instabilities. And one property of neutrino-driven convection, which I want to highlight, is this chi parameter, which compares the Brun-Weissala timescale to the advection timescale across the gain region. So the important information here is that in contrast with convection in a hydrostatic equilibrium, here the convection develops in a flow which has a strong, a significant advection component, and so the gas spends only a finite time in the region where the entropy gradient is negative, and after that, the gas reaches the vicinity of the neutron star, where the entropy gradient is stable, the stratification is stable. The reason for this shape of the entropy profile is that this reaction of neutronization dominates near the neutron star. So here, you emit neutrinos, so you decrease the entropy, whereas in this brown region, you capture neutrinos on neutrons, for example, and so you increase the entropy. So as long as you're here, you increase, and then the opposite reaction dominates, and then you decrease, and you have a stable stratification. So this is the reason why you should compare the two timescales, and if the advection timescale is too short compared to the Brünn-Weissala timescale, then it's linearly stable. And so for the standing accretion shock instability, the basics of this instability relies on some coupling.
Just a quick question here. Yeah. So are there progenitors for which it's actually stable, where you don't see the convection?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know. I think there can be, but I haven't seen any study to find out the answer. I mean, yeah, it's just a matter of the size. You can really reduce this argument to the size of the gain region. If the region where neutrino capture is very thin, there is no way that it can be the same. So this other instability relies on some coupling processes, some linear coupling processes between acoustic waves and advected waves, both entropy and vorticity waves. And so you have a cycle which can be unstable in the sense that the acoustic wave after the acoustic wave triggered by the advection of some vorticity perturbation has a bigger amplitude than the acoustic wave which triggered the vorticity perturbation on the shock. So there is a Q parameter for this efficiency, the combination of the efficiency at the shock and the efficiency near the neutron star. And this can be stable or not. Most of the time it's unstable, but it can compete with this buoyancy-driven, with this neutrino-driven convection. And what I'd like to mention right now is that this particular instability is L equal 1 and oscillatory, and it has very interesting consequences on the pulsar kick, the nucleosynthesis imprint that we see, for example, that was interpreted in Cas-A, viewed by a new star for titanium 44. You expect from this L equal 1 and 2 instability, gravitational waves, and a distinct neutrino signature. So that's quite important to distinguish between these two processes, because we have a way to have an observable way to distinguish them, in particular a direct signature of those very inner regions through gravitational waves and neutrino detectors. So very quickly, I just explained with these two graphic arguments that why vorticity and acoustic waves are coupled. I mean, if you think of a vorticity perturbation advected onto a stratified atmosphere, so you imagine a very subsonic settling motion, then you see that any vertical motion will break the pressure balance, will break the hydrostatic equilibrium by lifting up some dense region and pushing down some less dense region. So that's how vorticity is coupled linearly to pressure waves. and entropy is also coupled to pressure waves for a different reason. is when you have an entropy perturbation, advected also in a settling atmosphere. So if this atmosphere has an enthalpy gradient or some temperature gradient due to compression, then the way some entropy perturbation is going to expand due to the higher temperature is different from the surrounding, because this has a perturbed entropy. The entropy relates volume and temperature, if you wish. And so this entropy perturbation, as it reaches hot region, is going to push the surrounding and generate this acoustic wave in a manner which can be very efficient, which is really dependent on how hot the region is here. Okay, this is just some brief summary. So the progress in 2D simulations has been very encouraging, and over the last few years, all sorts of progenitor masses have led to explosions, both in the NPA group and in the Oak Ridge group. So this was a very, they use similar methods, but it's not always easy to. So, and they use similar methods, and we could also see this in a pessimistic way, because they don't obtain exactly the same results. So, but still, there are two groups who obtain ab initio explosions, and these different explosions show different paths to explosion. In particular, the lightest progenitors show a high value of this chi parameter, and so a strong convective instability, and no strong sign of a global oscillation due to size. Whereas this 27 solar mass progenitor, which I showed you in 3D, does explode in 2D with very big Sazy oscillations. So there are apparently different ways to reach an explosion, and the common, some interpretation is that this Sazy oscillation is able to bring in some turbulent pressure, which helps push the shock further out, and then increase the size of the gain region, which is going to be able to absorb neutrinos when they arrive in the end. And in the end, it's still a neutrino-driven explosion, but it's not necessarily driven at the beginning by neutrino-driven convection. You can have weak neutrino energy at the beginning, the shock pushed outwards, and then neutrinos have an easier work to do, because they have a larger region where they can be absorbed.
Can I ask, so 11.2, they all are still RN4 progenitors?
No, so when you...
Where you start oxygen...
So in principle, it's 10, it's for about 10 solar masses that you have an iron core. So there may be a trick here, because I think the lightest progenitor has a different metallicity, but I should have mentioned that in the range 8 to 10 for normal metallicities, you have an oxygen neon magnesium core, and then the explosion is much easier. There is not
so, but those, they all assume iron core, so this is the risk for iron cores.
Yes, let's say it's the. I cannot give you a 100% answer for this particular one, but the problems I'm dealing with concerning those instabilities are for progenitors which don't explode in 1D, whereas the 8 to 10 solar masses progenitors explode in 1D with possible interesting 2D effects, but they have a much easier explosion process, because they don't have to overcome much dynamical pressure from the infalling material. Okay, so I will... I thought it would be useful for those who don't know this experiment to see it, but I know some people have never seen it. So this is a way to make things more intuitive to understand those instabilities. So here you have a shallow water experiment, which mimics the gas experiment, and here is a shallow water simulation, 2D simulation of the experiment. And you, what's interesting is that this coupling between acoustic waves and vorticity perturbation takes place in the same manner in shallow water. Simply, surface gravity wave in water replace acoustic waves. So this is just to convince those who don't believe in numerical simulations that such instabilities exist in the real world, of terrestrial world. And so I don't want to spend time on this, but this analogy of the hydraulic jump and the shock wave is quite useful, it's quite intuitive. And I just want to remind you that this hydraulic jump is the same one that you see in your kitchen sink. But here it's reversed. So I don't want to expand on the equations. I just want to say that when you do...
Can I ask a question before we leave this topic? You put it like there's the SASE and there's the small-scale neutrino-driven turbulence. Is there a clear impact on the neutron star kick? I mean...
Yes.
So yes, from the kicks which we see, can you distinguish what happens?
So, actually, when I said that we believe in the core collapse scenario, one of the nice outcomes of this scenario is indeed the possibility to produce strong kicks, especially with this L equal 1 character of SASE. And so, all the work done in Garching by Sheik et al., Thomas Yanka, and Wong Watanarat, Anup Wong Watanarat, have really shown the development of some L equal 1 mode, which has always been interpreted as SASE. And so, for me, the kick is one strong evidence for the kick of pulsars, can be viewed as a strong evidence for SASE. But I know that even with a convex, with buoyancy-driven scenarios, in some circumstances, you manage to have a L equal 1 asymmetry, which is not oscillatory, which suddenly inflates in one direction. So I have seen this. I have not seen any strong claims that this was a big source of a kick. But I know that L equal 1 asymmetry can develop in the neutrino-driven convection phase.
Can it be argued the other way around as well? Because we know from some binaries that there are also neutron stars born without a kick or with a very, very small kick. So can we say the SASE
no.
didn't play a role there?
No, you're not allowed. No, because this very nice work of Sheik et al. 2004 and 6 made a statistical study, I mean, parametrized study with, 100 or more explosions. And the distribution of kick is a stochastic variable ranging from 0 to 1,000 kilometers per second. So this was 2D axisymmetric simulations, but with a peak compatible with 300 or observations. It's really a stochastic variable. I mean, you have it, especially in these axisymmetric simulations, you have an oscillation of the shock, and at some point the energy absorbed in the gain region becomes sufficient to inflate, but there's a kind of, it looks like a kind of a phase random variable. So at the point of explosion, the direction of the flow can be anything between plus 300 and minus 300.
So just to clarify, because in binaries we usually deal with strict envelopes, right? But here it's just the core. So if the core is similar to the core of a massive star, and SASE plays the same qualitative role of like in stripped stars and non-stripped stars. Is that correct?
Yeah, I don't distinguish stripped
or observations, for example, of double neutron star systems, we know that
that's the last supernova.
There's a class of neutron stars where systematically there's very small kicks. So you can argue
If you make a statistic argument, yes. The way to avoid a kick is to avoid a kick on average is indeed to get rid of SASE. If you have a quick explosion, if you have an electron capture supernova, you don't have a kick.
I thought that was one standard argument for the binary pulsar case, for exactly that reason. That was
because the second one is very tiny in mass?
Sure. And there are small masses that you can start in the lower axis. So
it's interpreted as an electron capture?
Yes. Well, there are people who say that even a strict iron core can do it, which is what Thomas Starr is talking about. Maybe you can tell whether the strict iron core can still do it.
I don't know about the strip. But I know if you don't leave enough time for those, if the explosion is too fast, you will not get a kick from this kind of mechanism. That's the only thing I'm confident about, but I don't know about the rest. I'm a bit worried about time for Ken. Okay. So here I just want to emphasize the fact that the amplitude of the kick, or the amplitude of the asymmetry, I said the kick can be a stochastic variable, but the amplitude of the asymmetry, or the maximum amplitude of the asymmetry, depends significantly on the strength of the L equal 1 SASE mode. So here you have an example of a size instability for a shock radius, too small to develop a strong L equal 1 mode. So you have a kind of a sloshing mode without rotation. Whereas here, for a shock which was initially further away, you have a clear direction of rotation. And so depending on this shock radius, the degree of asymmetry is measured here. It's like 10% compared to spherical. If you have a 10%, 20%, 50% increase of the shock radius in one direction, and here is the average increase of the shock radius due to this turbulent pressure which accumulates below the shock. So here you have a 20, 60, 100% increase of the shock radius. And so Jérôme Guillet and Rodrigo Fernandez were able, based on this simple parametrized model where you don't really have neutrino transport but just have a cooling function, they were able to translate the final spin period due to this rotation motion as a function of the mass accretion rate and the neutrino luminosity, and show that you can obtain typically spin periods of 100 milliseconds. And it's difficult to be faster than that due to this simple physics, but you can spin up a neutron star even if the progenitor does not rotate in the beginning. So now we reach this nice 1D description where you noticed immediately this very fragmented this very non-monotonous, non-continuous outcome of the explosions. So and it's important to distinguish two causes. One is the complexity and sometimes the stochasticity that we see during the explosion process. But most of this stochasticity here is due to stellar evolution itself. So if you measure, if you measure the compactness of the stellar core as a function of the mass, so this is before explosion, you see that you have exactly the same kind of wiggles, discontinuities, and this is this is due to solar evolution. We saw the complexity of those different regions of shell burning. Or I'm not a specialist of this field, but you know better than me that stellar evolution is not a smooth process over this this wide range of progenitor masses. So apparently, there are branching points where you can go in one direction or the other, depending on the initial mass.
Can you remind at which stage this compactness parameters is taken from the models?
Yes.
Because of course it can change. In
yes. So the let me see the compactness. I think the compactness parameter is measured when the central density reaches 8 × 10^10. There's a density, and they make sure to choose a density when the core is still hydrostatic. I mean, before the collapse, yeah. As late as possible, but before the collapse. I think I have this number later on. Maybe on the next. Maybe it's on the next slide. Yeah, here, 5 × 10^10.
Yeah, I think their argument, if I remember correctly, is that those kind of the bumps and wiggles are shell, convective shells merging, separating as you change the mass. You know, the oxygen cell, silicon shell, things right on the outside are just fluctuating around. Now, how much that's, you know, that's a pretty hard thing to model, but I think that's the argument.
Yeah. So here I would, before we go back, we continue on this stochasticity, I'd like to mention one of the nice outcomes of this kind of study is that it can predict many things. It can predict nucleosynthesis, which I'm not commenting on here, but it can also predict the distribution of neutron star masses, and also, so which you see here on this histogram compared to the dashed line, which is observations, so you have some reasonable agreement, and the different colors describe different bins of initial masses.
This is comparing apples and pears, of course, because the observations are all in binary systems.
So those masses are not
volatile things. We know binary evolution will affect all of this.
So it's not reliable.
I don't think it's meaningful.
Okay.
And. I've been trying to be quiet, but I can't do it. The lovely work by Tug and Stan is for, there are many different parameters that will impact all of those things. The amount of rotation, they've picked zero rotation.
They don't have to. Yeah, this is okay.
The amount of mixing by overshooting, they don't have that. All of those things, the list keeps going.
Yeah.
So what you're seeing here is for one particular set of parameters, the only thing that's being changed is the Zanos mix. Please, please, please don't be misled into thinking that this is the truth for a very Zanos mix. I know you're not.
I'm not.
But the person who looks at this plot is very much led to think, to generalize way.
I agree. I
so see. All those numbers, all those distributions are extremely uncertain in terms of looking at reasonable distributions of these other parameters.
But what's meaningful, first, it's to me this kind of work is the goal that we are trying to reach, and we are still very far.
Higher.
We are far from it, but we would like to have such a panorama. And we would like to be able to predict those things. So I was trying to be positive before criticizing.
Proud of you.
One of the other interesting outcome, but I don't know if it's meaningful or not, is that if you do the same for black hole masses, you find that the black hole masses obtained in those non-exploding cases are compatible with the known distribution of black hole masses if you assume that you got rid of the a hydrogen envelope. So the if you simply keep the helium core mass in black, then you have black hole masses down to five solar masses. Whereas if you don't get rid of this hydrogen envelope, then you would have two massive black holes from such an approach. So I don't think they elaborate on why you should systematically lose the hydrogen envelope. But this is one unexpected outcome of this study. But of course, I fully agree with you that this is just. I mean, the interesting aspect is at least to give you the shape of a kind of panorama that you can expect. We should expect a fragmented panorama with regions of non-explodability and regions of explosion. But everything here can change, especially since, as you said, rotation is neglected, so it's singular star evolution. And to me, the most embarrassing thing is that all this parametrized study is calibrated on two supernovae. One is the CRAB for 10 solar masses explosions, so which affects the low mass explosions here. And one is around 18 solar masses for 87A, where they ask their model to reproduce the amount of nickel mass and the explosion energy of 87A. But and all the rest is calibrated on 87A, so up to 30 solar masses, 40 solar masses, when we know that 87A is a very particular explosion. So it's not their fault that we only have one well-observed supernova. But so they really did the best that we can probably do. But at the moment, we need more. We need more.
The CRAB was an electron capture supernova, also not a.
Yes, but yes, indeed. But this is this range. No, but this range of 10 solar masses is understood as a electron capture supernova. So it's because they did this Kitaora paper and the Wanajo paper, so they really. Did nice simulations. This is probably the range where it's most reliable. This low mass. I'm not going up to 12 here. I'm just talking of this vicinity of 10 is probably the most reliable.
For non-rotating cases, which don't exist.
For the case when you have when you will be producing the five solar masses black hole, if you will get rid of the hydrogen envelope, but how well is known that hydrogen envelope will be accreted? I mean, the helium core, I understand, could be fall back, but how well we know that the whole hydrogen could be swallowed by the proton neutron star when it's turned into a black hole?
I don't know.
Why people don't think that it could be all swallowed?
No,
that wasn't shown in the simulations?
When you compute the mass, you have to decide what mass is. Is falling into the black hole, and then depending on the argument you're able to produce.
Well, the hydrogen envelope being ejected is that the question? Why is it the helium core mass, not the total mass?
That's why people assume that hydrogen can be all fall back.
I mean, that's this argument that the radiation of neutrinos changes the mass enough, which induces a shock, which unbinds the hydrogen.
So I think Natasha's question was the reverse question. So we're saying, did anybody really expect the hydrogen envelope would all be accreted?
Oh, I see. Got it. Yeah.
But Elliot, this neutrino energy, how much mass can you?
You can eject the hydrogen envelope.
The full hydrogen envelope.
The whole hydrogen envelope.
The whole for, I don't know about up at 30 solar masses, but I think between 15 and 20 something, yes. Because it's pretty weakly bound.
Okay.
The mass range 20-25 is most important mass range for chemical evolution. Nucleosynthesis stuff.
Excuse me?
Their nucleosynthesis products are most important for the chemical enrichment in the galaxy. So if they just fall back, you have that trouble with chemical evolution.
For the black holes?
Yeah.
That's a problem.
So you, of course, should be I think 1.5 is a good number.
So the black holes are sufficiently numerous that they would affect significantly the chemical evolution.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think that must be a bit strange in terms of the chemical evolution.
So do we have a bunch of other supernovae where we have progenitors. Can what are, in those cases, is the energy of the explosion, i.e. the energy of the ejecta, reasonably well known? So, I mean, I guess my question really is why, I understand 87 is obviously particularly well studied, but there are a dozen or whatever the number is in systems with other progenitors and reasonably well studied supernovae.
Yes, but I mean, when you look at the efforts to model the light curve of 87A, people have gained confidence in this one much more than any other.
Okay.
But I don't know.
Just specifically because this would get at your question.
No, but Elliot, the ones you have in mind, do they differ significantly in mass?
No, it's true. They go, I mean, what is the 18 or?
Most of them are less than 17.
Yeah. That's the dam's mass. So most of them are going to drop down.
Right. No, that's true. There's nothing where it's higher mass.
Yeah, right? but at least it could cure the fact that it was a peculiar star.
That was the
Okay. Ken, what do we do now? It's 45 minutes and I have many things to talk about. Well, let me finish on this and maybe I will skip the rotation part, which maybe we'll find another occasion to talk to about rotation. Here I just want to mention the fact that this compactness parameter is not a conclusive parameter to decide whether it explodes or not. And this is why the Garshin group has made some efforts to get a deterministic parameter, and they managed. But the cost of this effort is that the parameter they obtain is not as intuitive as the compactness parameter. So the parameters they obtain is the mass below, let's say, the mass below the oxygen shell. So that's at entropy equal 4. They measure the mass in the progenitor. And they also measure the derivative of the mass at this particular radius, which seems surprising. But with these two parameters, they are able to separate with, I don't remember the number, but with a 3% reliability, exploding and non-exploding cases of this particular 1D prescription. And so this is important because it tells you, this separation tells you that at least in their prescription, there is no stochasticity. They have a completely deterministic approach of the explosion, despite the mess that we had to start with this variations of compactness. Here they have a clear-cut separation. But of course, as we said, there are a series of other parameters which are not included. So they make some effort to connect these parameters to intuitive parameters. So this derivative scales like the mass accretion rate, and the product of these two numbers, which is the abscess here, scales like the neutrino luminosity. So they come back in a sense to this more intuitive approach, which was introduced by Burroughs and Gauchy in 1993, where you have this dividing line, where you have on the one hand the ram pressure due to advection, and on the other hand the neutrino power.
How do they test the solar models whether they're going to black holes or exploding in this case?
Sorry?
In the case on the right, where they're using their wonderful parameter for being able to separate those, they take stellar models and then they're having to decide whether this model is going to a black hole or it's exploding. How do they make that decision?
So in the 1D...
it's not a 3D simulation.
No, it's 3D. This corresponds to...
That was my question.
It's okay. this series of simulations.
Great. Right? Okay.
It's a 1D evolution with some prescriptions to mimic.
Great. So they've done that many stellar models to get... Okay, thank you. That's what I was asking. That's great.
Yeah, it's actually in the same paper. I mean, this is the Ertel paper, and this is the Sobol paper, but they are both out of both. Out.
So that's what one could also put the 3D models which one has, right?
On this one?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So would they... Would they
you need two fingers for that.
Yeah, no, yeah, just, the 27 solar mass would be interesting because it does not explode in 3D and it explodes in 2D, and I don't remember if they address this in this paper. I guess they do, but I don't remember.
Feeling about how this new formula change if you would put the star in binary and would just develop. So the core mass only gradient that is derivative. Density gradients are shallower in the binary case. So this would help you explode.
Steeper. So my last slide before I leave Ken is the last slide before rotation effects, which I will not talk about, is this pre-collapse inhomogeneities ingredient, which seems to be, which can be in some cases an important contributor to the explosion. So the first work on this was, quantitative approach was by Kouchanot in 2013, where the distinction, so this is the trajectory of the shock as a function of time, and they compared the trajectory when they tuned some neutrino heating parameter by 2%. And in addition, they decided to add or not some a field of velocity perturbations ahead of the shock with a Mach number 0.2 in these perturbations, and noticed that they were able to obtain an explosion in a case where this input was decisive. As compared to a case with a 2% increase of neutrino heating. So it was not very conclusive. It looked like they were really at the edge of an explosion, and this small ingredient was able to overcome the edge. But Bernard Müller more recently made a real simulation of oxygen burning and the collapse of the region of oxygen burning in the last 5 minutes before the explosion. And it shows 18 solar mass progenitor for which this region of oxygen burning is very close to the has a very small radius, and so they found that a big difference with this previous work is that the angular scale of the convective cells they obtain in this in their simulation has a very large scale, L equal 2, whereas in this case the dominant L was more like 5. And so if you're able to excite the shock with large scales, then it's much more efficient than trying to excite it on small scales, because large scales correspond to the most unstable perturbation of this post-shock region. And so in this case, they argue that the equivalent increase of luminosity that this pre-collapse inhomogeneities produce is of the order of 10 to 20%. So this is a very big number. They admit that they chose a favorable case with 18 solar masses, but it gives you the range of possible effects due to these pre-collapse inhomogeneities. Not only it brings some additional turbulent pressure, but it also acts as a forced oscillator. And if you manage to excite the oscillator with the correct wavelength, then it can be very efficient.
Isn't that also in 2 and 3D, I think, in a later the 15 paper, they point out that the difference of the explosions between 2 and 3D might be attributed to the fact that in 2D you have turbulence, which has an inverse cascade,
so
a larger scale structure.
Yeah, this is one worry of 2D simulations, that power may accumulate on the larger scale. So
this is going to be my question. Is there any reason to trust 2D simulations? No, honest question. Because not only do you have this issue of turbulence, but also you have basically an artificial symmetry and you have an axis. And so if you're talking about the development of a mode, the movies and 2D simulations always show motion along this.
No, but I want to be clear on this. It's all, I mean, as for the 1D paper of Subolt, it's very easy to wipe our feet on the on the difficulties of on the shortcomings of the models. But imagine when you don't have any, if you're stuck with 1D, you're very happy to do a 2D axisymmetric, even if it brings in some energy on the large scale. So you must be. So I wouldn't say that 2D simulations are of no use, just because it was the best that we could rely on when we had only 1D. Now that we can have 3D, of course, if you're rich enough to have 150 million CPU hours, you're welcome. But you must try to make sense of what's available. And you, having 2D doesn't mean that you will always have this sloshing motion, for example. In some cases, for 11.2 solar masses, you're dominated by neutrino. So it's not that straightforward to say, oh, my power is going to accumulate on large scale. You don't always have time to build up this power, and you have different instability processes which can rule the evolution. So I really value those 2D simulations, but I'm ready to point out their shortcomings. Okay, so sorry, Ken, this is a bit long. I hope we'll find time to talk about those rotation issues on another day.
So, just last question. So, if there's a reduction on critical neutrino luminosity in this case, so does it mean that there will be more failures? Like, is it more likely to form a black hole in this case? What's the outcome? I mean, what's the effect of the reduction of critical luminosity?
It means you make more supernova explosions. If you reduce the critical luminosity, it means that it's easier to explode. Okay. You don't need to tune artificially the neutrino power to obtain explosion. You obtain it for lower values. This is the kind of list of ingredients that I would like to fill in the end. So this was my conclusion slide. Where I show the kind of ingredients that we are dealing with in this phase of collapse and dynamics. We have some constraints on the side of neutron star and black hole properties, and we have all these steps between zero age main sequence evolution, and giant supergiant phase, and to end up with a pre-collapse structure that we are feeding in the models. And so I hope that during this program I can fill in this region to see how they connect to those parameters. We'll have time to discuss this in more detail. Okay.
So back to Ryan's question, maybe quickly. I think the 2D simulations were and have been extremely useful, you know, providing physical intuition about the role of turbulence and large-scale asymmetries. But maybe if one wanted to ask, are they quantitatively useful, for instance, even if it's not quantitatively exactly right?
It seems you can test how useful the 2D is by comparing it to your few 3Ds.
Yeah.
So if they are predicting